Oscar Pettiford is one of the greatest musicians ever. Not just one of the greatest bass players, but just as a musician, he was very singular. He was one of the first bass players, if not the first bass player, who took the language of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and played it on the bass.
By force of talent, skill, inspiration, and gifts that flowed through his fingers, Oscar Pettiford changed the way the bass was heard, played, and appreciated. He grew up in the music, became the music, plucked it from the bass in melodies and rhythm lines all his own, composed tricky, simple tunes. And to that, he added the jazz cello, all done with great care and with such a rich, on-target tone. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles. On this program, bassist, composer, bandleader, Oscar Pettiford.
All he had to do is play a couple of notes, and you know who it is. He had a style.
What Oscar Pettiford brought to the scene was not only a continuing development of Jimmy Blanton's style, but for the first time that we know of a bass player's compositions that were really meaningful and to today are still bass players' nightmares.
By the time Oscar Pettiford was a teenager, Duke Ellington sought him out. Barely into his 20s, he was hanging and playing, bebopping, with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie, Bird, Parker, and the others on Manhattan's 52nd Street scene, reshaping that most American of music, jazz. And Pettiford did it on the timekeeper, the bottom, the bass, building on the legendary Ellington bassist of the late 30s, Jimmy Blanton. O.P., as he was known, drove more than just time. Legendary bassist Milt Hinton, the judge.
What I find, the hardest thing about anything I want to do is be able to do what my mind can say it to do. I've never made my hands catch up to the ability of my mind to do something. I have to compensate. I start something, I say, I better not try that. I don't think I can make that. Pettiford wouldn't do that. He can make it. He'd go on and make it.
Oscar Pettiford was born September 30, 1922, and passed on just short of his 38th birthday in Copenhagen, Denmark. Few years, but thousands of miles from his birthplace, on an Indian reservation in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Pettiford's father was Cherokee and African-American. His mother was Choctaw. O.P. didn't talk about his heritage much. He did with French horn player David Amram.
If people would make jokes about it, which they used to back then, he would never mention it again. He would kind of put it out there maybe once and then see if anybody had any interest and respect about that. But that was something that he felt very deeply and he cared very much about.
Oscar Pettiford's father was a veterinarian who started what was called in the 1920s a musical organization, the Pettiford Family Band, including Doc Pettiford's wife, who taught the group theory and harmony, Oscar and his 10 brothers and sisters. Actor Kermit Frazier in the words of Oscar Pettiford.
Musically, it was well in advance of most bands. We played mostly our own material. We only played the standards to please the squares.
The Gershwin tune, I Got Rhythm, was a favorite. When Oscar's age was still in single digits, the family moved from Oklahoma to Minnesota. The family band performed around the Midwest. By the time he was 10, Oscar was out front, singing and dancing, sometimes twirling a baton, putting on a show. A year later, he was playing piano, and not too long after, at the age of 14, the teenage Pettiford was drafted to play the bass, an instrument he hadn't tried before. The bass player had gotten married and left. Apparently, Oscar was a quick study.
I figured out my own technique. The way the bass was being played at the time wasn't gassing me. They weren't getting any sound on the instrument. They were slapping more than they were playing. And a lot of it was just clowning up the instrument. So I started myself on my own system before I heard anybody else try to play it like an instrument.
Ken Green and Oscar Pettiford became friends when both were in their mid-teens and living in Minneapolis.
When I first met him, he was, instead of being what was called an oompah bass player, in other words, just a two-beat or four-beat, just dum-dum-dum, dum-dum-dum, dum-dum-dum. It was dum da 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 dum or da 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 dum dum. In other words, he would double or triple the beat and create tunes. He had a strong melodic line to his bass playing, along with being a very muscular player. The style that he was playing was similar to the young bass player named Jimmy Blanton. Blanton was only with Ellington about 2 years and died at age 22 of tuberculosis. Oscar was the logical successor to and progression from Jimmy Blanton. And at that time, as so far as anybody knew, only he and Blanton were playing that way.
Jack the Bear, recorded in March 1940, was Blanton's signature tune. Just 4 years older than O.P., Jimmy Blanton was the man who, between 1939 and 41, defined the bass in the Ellington Band, who first played melody on those four before rhythm only, strings. Like Pettiford, he was from the South, and he'd played in a band with his pianist mother before moving on. But it was almost Pettiford, not Blanton, who made the bass breakthrough first, at least with the Duke. This is Pettiford's version of Jack the Bear.
One night, Duke Ellington heard me at an after-hour jam session and approached me to join the band. That was before Blanton. I was 14 or 15 and was breaking the law playing as it was, so I couldn't join him. I did get to hear Blanton when I was about 17. When I heard him, I was in love with him right away. Our approaches were a lot alike.
The Judge, bassist Milt Hinton.
In 1936, I was with Cab Calloway's band, and we were traveling all over the country. And we hit Minneapolis, Minnesota, and there was Oscar. I said, why don't you come down to the theater tomorrow? So the next day, we had a jam session backstage, and he came down. And the guys heard him play. He was so magnificent, Cab wanted to fire me and keep him.
Milt Hinton came through town from time to time with Cab Calloway. He impressed me, too.
Actor Kermit Frazier as Oscar Pettiford.
I had quit bass and was working in a war plant around 1942. You could have starved to death trying to play music in Minneapolis then. Milt came into town with Cab, and I went by to see him. I hadn't played for about 5 months, and he wouldn't believe I'd quit playing. Milt talked me back into music. Man, he said, don't let talent go down the drain. There ain't nobody here playing like you, and you could more than hold your own in New York. New York had worried me. They used to tell us that if we went to New York from outside, some 15-year-old kid would blow us out of the room. Anyway, 2 months after I had that talk with Milt, Charlie Barnett came through Minneapolis and hired me right away.
In May 1943, Oscar Pettiford, just out of his teens, was ready to leave Barnett and make the big move. Blanton was dead. Now it fell to young Oscar to make the bass live. New York, New York, pre-World War II, it's a wonderful, jazzy town, the island of New York. Manhattan skyscrapers, a backdrop to the cluster of brownstone houses along Midtown's 52nd Street between 5th and 7th Avenues. On the ground floor of many, a small nightclub. The Onyx, the Three Deuces, Kelly Stables, the Famous Door, the Spotlight, Hickory House, the Yacht Club. Noisy, crowded. So crowded it was hard to even see the band. So crowded a patron could get a drink from one club and take it to the next and on again several times more. No one would notice. Musicians would trade chairs during the night and jam until the morning. Pettiford fit right in.
When I got to New York, I found Milt was right. I didn't have to worry.
First to seek Pettiford out was tenor sax player Coleman Hawkins, with whom he recorded in late 1943. From that date, the tune, The Man I Love, is considered a classic. A taste of the music becoming, of bebop, beyond swing, sparser, tighter, jangled and urban like the city that spawned it.
The birth of a new experimental music, I never saw anything experimental about it.
The kid from Oklahoma was playing with the big boys, Monk, Dizzy, Hawkins, Roach, Eldridge, Garner. If jazz was the edge, Pettiford was cutting it.
Oscar Pettiford was the first bebop bass player. I mean, he was the first one to really make those lines come alive on the bass violin.
Pianist and educator Billy Taylor was part of the 52nd Street scene. Sometimes he sat in with Dizzy and O.P.
Oscar Pettiford had the strength and the rhythmic capacity to do things that were on the same level with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. As a matter of fact, he was in the first bebop band to play on 52nd Street. Charlie Parker was supposed to make it, but he couldn't make it, so Don Bias was substituted for him. So it was Max, the bass of Oscar, trumpet of Dizzy, and they started without a piano player, but in the early days, like the first week or two of that engagement, the weight was right on Oscar and, you know, holding everything together because Max Roach was playing a lot of real bebop drums.
You're listening to a portrait of pioneering bassist and more, Oscar Pettiford, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson.
I would call him the bird of the bass.
Bassist Christian McBride is getting the same kind of attention. McBride says that Pettiford could take those horn lines of Bird and Dizzy and translate them, transpose them for his instrument, the bass. No mean feat.
You know, you can hear Charlie Parker play the same song 50 million times and it would always strike you as something magical. And Oscar Pettiford had the same thing. Even now, some 40 years later, it still has the same impact as it did then. You know, I don't say that he's from another planet to be funny, but, you know, there's a lot of musicians who come here and just change the way their instruments are played forever. And Oscar Pettiford is one of those people.
In November 1945, Pettiford joined Duke Ellington, where he stayed until 1948. During a 1946 Carnegie Hall concert, Duke threw a new tune at Kay Davis, Lawrence Brown, Jimmy Hamilton, and O.P., having them perform it then and there for the first time. Pettiford liked the challenge. His words, as read by actor Kermit Frazier.
It had always been my ambition to play with Duke. But when I joined him, some of the guys I really wanted to play with had left the band. The only real enjoyment I got from working with Duke was concerts, because then we'd get to play some new things. At dances and theaters, we'd play the same thing over and over again. There was nothing to inspire you.
And now, a little tune to present our two bassists, Oscar Pettiford and Junior Ragland.
Basso Profundo, Oscar Pettiford, with Duke Ellington and his orchestra at Carnegie Hall on December 27, 1947. Bassist Aaron Bell was with Ellington in the 1950s. Like Pettiford, he was from Oklahoma. They became friends.
He'd take the theme and build on it and develop it. You know where we came from, as opposed to somebody who just knows the chords and just plays the chord, but having nothing to do with the melody. Some people do that on their solos, but he would tell a story from here to there.
Bass player Ray Brown was also a friend of Oscar's.
He loved to play solos. I think that was important to him. Rhythm was okay, but it wasn't a big deal. He never liked my bassist because he used to come around and say, "You still playing that old truck?" He used to call my bass a truck. It was a big Italian bass. Everybody in the bass world loved this bass damn near. It was a bass that had rings on it. And it was a gorgeous sound, great for playing rhythm. Okay, you had to work a lot to get solos out of it because it was so big. And I would play his bass, and boy, it would play like butter, you could fly up and down it. But it didn't have that big, fat rhythm sound. But he wasn't as interested in rhythm as he was in solos.
Those solos reminded many musicians of the guitar lines of Charlie Christian, fluid lines. But Pettiford's posture with his bass was anything but. Look at a photograph of Oscar Pettiford, and you see a man standing stiffly by his instrument. Not the familiar bear hug of many musicians and their bass. This relationship looks formal, chaste. Bassist Christian McBride and Ray Brown trade off.
He's standing straight up also. A lot of bass, they tell you it's supposed to kind of lean the instrument on you, but he's like almost parallel with the instrument.
And play the ass off of it. See, what I'm saying, don't worry about how a guy holds it. Just listen to what's coming out. Because I've seen thousands of people look perfect. And they're playing shit, Excuse my expression.
That just goes to show you, he was a freak of nature. Any teacher, if you played the way he played, with your thumb straight up behind the neck, every teacher would say, don't play like that. That's wrong, It's technically wrong. But I would much rather play wrong and sound like Oscar Pettiford and play right and sound horrible.
Oscar Pettiford's best-known composition, Trichotism.
have a boxer, a good boxer, who feints and jabs, you know. He doesn't overwhelm you with a lot of notes, you know. Just enough to make it interesting. And you get a chance to listen. You're not overwhelmed with 1,500 notes per minute. A lot of us play the bass these days like we're getting paid by the note. I think that's what I loved about Oscar Pettiford. He didn't play a lot of notes, but what he played was so good. Right to the point. People who have this natural talent I'm talking about don't play wrong notes. The system that they have, that their brain, whatever it is, it's like a bat at night, you know? They never run into a wall.
Oscar Pettiford knew what he had in mind for his instrument.
The bass is one of the most important, if not the most important, instruments in any orchestra. You can take just a bass and somebody can sing to it or play to it. You don't need piano or drums. The bass can be much more of a horn, too, than it often has been in the past. When I finish, the bass will be right down front where it belongs.
Pettiford in particular, you listen to all of those records and all you hear is the note. I mean, it's just so crystal clear. And recording techniques were also in the early stages, you know, weren't really that developed in the 40s and 50s. And for him to get such a great sound with that kind of equipment, you can imagine what it must have sounded like in person. I mean, I can't imagine. His most popular work, Trichotism, gosh, you listen to that bass sound on there. I mean, it's like almost like a bass marimba. You know, it's just so crystal clear.
Oscar Pettiford, a musician with an agenda, a focus. Trombonist, J.J. Johnson.
He was a sharp dresser, neat, clean, always. His music reflected that preoccupation with perfection, that preoccupation with doing things the right way, and neatness, precision, being articulate, being right on, being in control of the moment. All of that was Pettiford.
And much more. For there was another side of Pettiford, one that musicians who knew and played with him, both on stage and off, don't want to talk about much now. It's almost as if Oscar's exercising control from the beyond, the bandleader from Ghostland, reshaping his sometimes tempestuous history. Witness, Ray Brown.
Just didn't take no shit from nobody. He was strong as an ox. And then if he had a few drinks, look out. He could whip four guys if he had to, you know. That's not the kind of stories I want to tell.
Pettiford's anger, his rages, are legendary. While the history of bebop is enmeshed with stories of musicians and drugs, for Oscar, the lure and love wasn't for heroin, but for drink. First Aaron Bell, then Ray Brown, give us the story of O.P. and his Jones.
And he drank Scott. He drank. I think O.P. drank anything. He didn't care what it was. If that's all you had, that's what he drank.
Listen, I used to go see Oscar in New York. I've seen this same situation in Paris. I've seen it in New York. It's the last set around 3:30 in the morning. And Oscar is so drunk, he can't get out of the chair. And they pick him up and carry him up to the bandstand and lean him into the crook of the piano and hand him his bass and play the shit out of it. I don't know how the hell he did it. I get drunk, I can't even find my bass, much less play it. But they would stand him up in the crook of the piano and then he would play his butt off.
Swan Bebop bassist Oscar Pettiford just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Jazz Profiles on NPR National Public Radio. There's a photo of the otherwise dapper Oscar Pettiford, neat suit, neat bow tie, with a frayed gauze bandage around his right hand, playing away, music, not softball. Saxophonist Jerome Richardson.
He was accident prone. Something would happen to him all the time. He'd break this and break that.
And finally, one of those broken bones led to a change of style and the addition of an instrument. An instrument that he first picked up while playing with Woody Herman in 1949. He worked with Herman for 5 months and enjoyed being with saxophonist Dan Getz and Zoot Sims and other young guys. These were men whose sensibilities jived with O.P.'s, that and a shared love for a good joke, even on their band leader.
The band was at the Adams Theater in Newark. And between sets, we were invited over to a music store run by Bob Gutentag, a bass player. A cello was sitting up on the counter. I picked it up, started fooling around, and started to play. Someone said, "You ought to play that on the show." When the time came for my solo, I put my bass down and walked off stage. Woody looked at me like I'd blown my top. Woody's manager, who was in on the gag, handed me my cello in the wings, and I played it in the solo spot.
While with Woody Herman, Oscar broke his arm playing softball and sat out performing for many months, experimenting with the cello. When he started playing again, audiences expected to see him on bass. Often, he played cello. A case of the incredible shrinking instrument? Jerome Richardson.
Yes, they were surprised. They thought it was a little bass, maybe. Some of them did, you know. But they were curious as to what he was doing, what he was playing, and what kind of instrument that was and all that. Most of the musicians wanted to know how he played it so easily. And, of course, we found out that he had it all strung up like the bass. So, which was easy enough for him.
He still kept pretty much the same concept, you know, the real beautiful, long flowing, you know, bebop style lines.
Bassist Christian McBride.
He got the same clean tone on the cello he did on the bass. It's amazing. You never heard any slap, you know, you never heard any finger popping or any of that stuff. Just pure, clean note.
Perdido. Oscar Pettiford on cello, Duke Ellington on piano, February 1950.
Thank you.
Bassist composer Charles Mingus and Oscar Pettiford were both alumni of and shared a respect for Duke Ellington. Mingus and Pettiford knew each other, made music together, vied for the post-Blanton next great bassist mantle. Trombonist J.J. Johnson.
Friendly competition. I mean by that that Pettiford had tremendous respect for Mingus and vice versa. Mingus had tremendous respect for Pettiford. I mean, they were friends. And the little rivalry that went on, we knew what it was all about. A little one-upmanship here and there. They were similar in that they both had this sense of humor that bordered on the bizarre on occasion. The more I think about it, we all know what a tyrant Mingus could be, what a rebel Mingus could be. And Pettiford was a rebel and a maverick. We're talking mavericks here. When you talk Mingus and Pettiford, you're really talking mavericks.
But Oscar wanted to play, in quotes, correctly.
Pianist Dick Katz.
He wanted the right chords. He didn't want any funny stuff. If it was something creative, he would buy it. But if it was off the wall and didn't fit the piece, no. Whereas Mingus was a much more of a tightrope walker as far as music goes.
Mingus, just 6 months Pettiford senior, lived nearly two decades longer. Time to write more, lead more, play more, to become the better known. Then they both made some extraordinary music, occasionally together, often with OP on cello, an instrument Mingus had played as a child. Here, on a December 1953 recording, with Mingus on bass and Pettiford on cello, with an original OP composition, The Pendulum at Falcon's Lair. Though a prolific performer, Oscar Pettiford composed just about two dozen pieces.
That's a whole lot.
Bassist, jazz cellist, and educator, Ron Carter.
I mean, at the time, bass players weren't looked upon as composers, and unless you had your own band, it was difficult to get them performed by other band leaders. We don't know how many songs he wrote and that were not recorded.
Some, like Trichotism, have become standards and heard in other artists' repertoires. Marion McPartland's adapted it for the piano. Ray Brown tackles it on bass. But it's tricky, and lots of artists avoid it. Still, it's the bassist who truly appreciate Pettiford's gifts to fellow bassists, like Ron Carter and Al McKibben.
Oscar's melodies are written to be played on the bass. They're across the bass, they're not a lot of big jumps. It's easy to stand to them because there's not a lot of odd intervals that require a lot of movement to find. I mean, Blues in the Closet is five notes, but they're great five notes, and they're laid perfectly on the bass. Laverne Walk, the largest interval is probably seventh, but it's laid.
I like playing Laverne Walk. It just lays, it just rolls from the bass. It's perfect on the bass, and as far as position is concerned. And melodic.
This is NPR's Jazz Profiles, and I'm Nancy Wilson with a tribute to Oscar Pettiford. The Pettiford Composition, The Gentle Art of Love.
Oscar Pettiford was probably the first, how should we say, super bassist. that became a band leader.
In the mid-1950s, Oscar formed a 13-piece orchestra. French horn player David Amram was in it.
He said, I'm going to show the symphony world I can have my own orchestra, just like Duke Ellington did. We're going to have my cello and two French horns and a harp. He said, we're going to give them some competition. And we all used to chuckle because it seemed so unusual at that time to have an orchestra using those instruments.
Ron Carter.
I guess we kind of take this curiosity of instrumentation for granted, because when we hear it, it sounds so acceptably normal that we don't think that, well, back in those days, in the mid-50s, that no one was using harp in a jazz band, and that no one was using two French horns and two cellos. Or those kind of combinations just weren't an everyday band instrumentation. But when we hear them again, it sounds so okay and sounds so why didn't I think of it-ish that we don't think that how far ahead of his time he was as far as assembling those kinds of instruments in the jazz band.
In the fall of 1958, Pettiford went on a tour to Europe as part of a Jazz from Carnegie Hall package. The acclaim from audiences and critics in Europe far exceeded OP's reception at home, so he decided to stay, first living in Germany, then Denmark. Jerome Richardson.
I don't think he left specifically to go to Europe and stay. He left like a lot of other black musicians have done, gone over that way and found out that they were being treated as human beings. So they stayed.
In Vienna in January 1959, Pettiford recorded this extraordinary version of Stardust. His pillow soft touch on ballads is evident here. It's enough to make you swoon. Life in Europe meant clubs, radio, and television dates. It wasn't the level of acclaim Oscar had hoped for, but it was a decent living. He had a good stint at the Café Montmartre with Stan Getz and a regular touring group with Hans Kohler and Attila Zoller. Heard on this recording from Vienna. Thank you. Oscar Pettiford met his end in Copenhagen, just 9 months after Stardust. He'd been in a serious car accident in the United States in 1956 and another in Austria in late 1958. To make a recording date after that crash, he showed up with his head in bandages. He'd fractured his skull, and a photograph shows Pettiford with a Frankenstein-like scar zigzagging its way down his forehead, covering a metal plate within. And then he had a bicycle accident, landing on his head, where the plate was. Guitarist Attila Zoller heard the story from Pettiford's wife.
By 6 o'clock in the morning, he just could move his eyes. They took him to the hospital, and the same day, I think, he just, no pain, nothing. They talked to him, he understood everything, but he just stopped living, she said.
There are conflicting reports about what did happen. Pettiford received a lot of press in death. By some accounts, he was in the hospital for several days and died of a mysterious virus, or polio, or something else. On his death certificate, the cause was listed as unknown. Jerome Richardson visited Pettiford in the hospital.
I didn't stay there very long. I couldn't stand to look at him. He was optimistic, hoping that he would beat it. But he had, what we found out later on, Lou Gehrig's disease. That's what we understand is what he died of.
Whatever the cause, on the 8th of September, 1960, at age 37, jazz lost a pioneer bassist, cellist, composer, and bandleader, Oscar Pettiford. Our tribute to Oscar Pettiford was written and produced by Karen Michelle. David Gorin mixed the program. Special thanks to Ken Green, Dave Sletten, Charles Waters, Stephanie Stein, the Stephen Erickson Studio, NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus, Monica Petty of RCA BMG, and Terry Henty of Fantasy Records. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith. Our website coordinator is Bettina Owens. Executive producers, Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us or for more information about this and other Jazz Profiles programs, check out NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web. Our address is npr.org. Again, that's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.